Hey, this is Matt, and I'm building some custom doors in Forest Park, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 969. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studios. So hello to Bob. And hey, if you've ever taken a sunrise stroll along the lakefront, maybe by the South Shore Cultural Center or along the Loyola Beach on the north side, you know that it's a pretty special place. I mean, it's our collective front yard. It's where kids learn to ride bikes, where folks fish in quiet reflection, where runners, dog walkers, and those who are just daydreaming get a place to hang out with a freedom that can be a much needed break from our daily routines. And that freedom wasn't handed to us. It was demanded by generations who fought to keep our lakefront open, clear, and free, just as Daniel Burnham envisioned, not parceled off to the highest bidder. We'll be taking a look at the future of our lakefront on the show today. But this public space is only part of what we're up to on the program today. Public voice matters too. And right here in the city, Second Glance Productions is helping redefine who gets seen and heard. They're a Chicago-based production company centering LGBTQ plus lives, perspectives, and stories with depth, honesty, and power. Whether it's a scripted series that explores LGBTQ joy or maybe a documentary diving into intersectional identity, Second Glance isn't just making media, they're making space. And speaking of making space and kindness, did you see the story that's gone viral this week? Former Chicago Alderman Edwin Eisendrath was spotted on the Blue Line giving his own jacket to a man who appeared cold and homeless. There was no fanfare, no staged cameras, just a quiet act of compassion. A fellow rider captured it on their phone, and now the moment's being shared across the country. Eisendrath said simply, quote, "We don't have enough examples right now of common decency," end quote. And I'll tell you, in this region where we live, that decency, I think, still matters. Oh, and we'll get the latest on some new local music from guitarist Rob Moore. He's been playing blues in Chicago for over 50 years. So whether it's keeping the lakefront open for all, lifting up unheard voices through the lens of a camera, or just offering a coat to someone in need, it all comes down to the same thing. Chicago works best when it works for everyone. Let's get to it. Chicago's lakefront is a true asset and really the jewel of the Midwest. And for years, Chicago has professed that the lakefront will remain forever open, clear, and free. However, there are some challenges to this. Over the years, the city has debated what, if anything, to build on the lakefront, from multi-billion dollar developments to quite possibly a new stadium for the Bears. I think there was a George Lucas Museum in there somewhere at one point. There's a lot of interest in developing this valuable land. Open Lands is a local nonprofit that protects the natural and open spaces of northeastern Illinois and the surrounding region, and they have a new report out right now called The Chicago Lakefront, Protected Yet Precarious. Emily Reiswig is the Vice President of Conservation and Policy at Open Lands, and she is here with us today on Outside the Loop to talk about this new report. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So, okay, the need for this report. So, look, I grew up around here, and many of us from this area might think that, well, the lakefront, isn't it protected space? We hear about this. We've heard about this over the years, that there are protections when it comes to the lakefront. So With this report, what is the purpose of it? What were you setting out to do here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be clear, the lakefront is protected, right? It's out, most of it is owned by the Chicago Park District and therefore us. But when we looked back at the last few years, we think the city has gone through, you know, kind of a cycle of debates on development on the lakefront, and from the Lucas Museum, as you mentioned, to the Chicago Children's Museum, the Obama Center, now the Bears Stadium. And we just felt that a thorough legal analysis of how the lakefront is governed, how it's protected, could perhaps shed some light on why we keep having these discussions about development along our lakefront, and perhaps how we could strengthen these protections so that we're not in this kind of defensive mode when it comes to thinking about developments and are thinking a little more visionary and long-term about what our lakefront should look like in the next 5, 10, 20 years.
Right. So that's part of this report where you talk about that the conversation isn't always a healthy one. You know, I think there are assumptions that, well, the thing is protected, so I think that'll be all right. But then you have these other interests that come into play here, and they see a lot of open space, and boy, it's valuable land. So a couple of the protections that are in place that you really talk about in this report, the public trust doctrine and the lakefront protection ordinance. So these are the two areas that you're focusing on here. But briefly, what do these do? What's this public trust ordinance? How does it work? And what's this lakefront protection ordinance all about?
So when we looked at the legal protections that govern the lakefront, we looked at two major protections, the public trust doctrine and the lakefront protection ordinance. The public trust doctrine really covers any land that was once a lakebed of Lake Michigan, which it turns out is a significant portion of the lakefront we know today. The law states that the land is for the public benefit. And so it needs to be for the public good. So just developing something for profit on this land is not legal. And anyone of any Illinois citizen can file suit in court to protect that public benefit. The Lakefront Protection Ordinance is a municipal law. And this, we thought, was the strongest way to protect the lakefront for the future. The Lakefront Protection Ordinance was created in the 1960s when we saw lots of development kind of happening along the lakefront. Lake Point Tower, McCormick Place East were a couple of examples. And so the city of Chicago created the Lakefront Plan of Chicago in 1972, and after that, the LPO. And it really creates a more structured and thorough review process for anything that goes on the lakefront. But we felt that this was really too subjective of a process for what we need today. And we really want to see more objectivity through our policy recommendations.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, some of the shortcomings here, because, yeah, the lakefront is technically protected. And we talked about the Lakefront Protection Ordinance and the public trust doctrine. But your report is called The Chicago Lakefront Protected Yet Precarious. So, and you started to talk about it there. Something's going on here where maybe we need some more protection from your point of view. Because with all this talk of development and building all kinds of things, and, you know, you mentioned a few there with McCormick Place and Lake Point Tower. I mean, there have been developments that have happened, but you're saying that we need to rethink this and it needs to be a little bit more sort of restrictive, or just we need to rethink this, how we think about it overall.
Yeah, I don't know if it's more restrictive, but it is. It should become more objective. So, for example, we want to require periodic updates to the Lakefront Plan of Chicago. This is something that's cited in the ordinance as following developments, but the Lakefront Plan of Chicago hasn't been updated since 1972. So it's more than 50 years old, and we don't think that that's something that people are even looking at. We had to go to the Chicago Public Library to find it. And we really want something that the citizens of Chicago, as well as government agencies, are really utilizing in the future. Another example is there are no design and use standards to guide any development. So we really want to require some guidelines for developers to follow if they are going to be proposing development on the lakefront. For example, bird-friendly glass. We saw this at McCormick Place East when they finally installed that protective film and saw a significant reduction in bird deaths on their windows. We want to see use standards, so minimum setbacks from the lake to ensure that our water remains clear and protected. We also want to mandate environmental impact studies. This was something that was originally in the Lakefront Protection Ordinance in 1973, and at some point in time was taken out. So currently it's at the discretion of the DPD commissioner whether they do an environmental review of the impact of a specific development. And we just feel like for anything on the lakefront, it really deserves a full understanding of what kind of impact the development will have on wildlife, will have on public access, as well as other things. So those are just a few of the things that we want to see to improve the Lakefront Protection Ordinance.
So you're saying that right now that's not always happening, those things that you would hope could happen, but we don't see that when people are proposing to build something on the lakefront, and you want to see that mandated.
Yes.
So I'm wondering here, and you don't have to talk about the Bears necessarily, but I mean, look, the Bears Stadium, that proposal got a lot of headlines, a lot of people talking about it. And the drawings looked really interesting and pretty and exciting. And look, I'm a Bears fan, right? So I can't help but get excited. But I mean, when you see something like that, is there any sort of consultation with your organization at Open Lands or just the, I mean, I know the city of Chicago is talking to the Bears, but when we think about the environmental impact, the public access situation, those things that you mentioned, is that kind of front and center, or is it, hey, take a look at this shiny thing that we're proposing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another reason why this report is hopefully helpful, because we really feel like a lot of the discussion and debate around lakefront developments are about the tax benefits, are about how much taxpayer dollars are going to be used, are about, you know, how awesome it's going to be to have this new stadium. All of that is very, very important. But we think that the intrinsic value of nature also needs to be centered. The fact that our lakefront is kind of unique in the world should be part of our conversation and how we protect that in the future. So is this development or any development outside of the Bears Stadium important to that long-term vision of an open, clear, and free lakefront? And how is it supporting that? And how is any development for the public benefit? These are all questions we need to be asking.
And I think it's really easy to take the lakefront for granted. Again, especially speaking from someone who's grown up here, look, I love to go to the lakefront. I love to go all up and down there. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. But I just kind of always assume that it's going to be there. But what we're saying here is, especially today, when we're thinking about revenue and there are budget shortfalls and, hey, can we get some money making, schemes in place? Sometimes I think it might be very easy to think about the lakefront as a place where we could make that happen. And people could make the argument, well, it's for the benefit of the entire city of Chicago. But I think, you know, it's one of these things where if you take it away, you don't realize what you have until it's gone. And
absolutely,
you know, I think like what's going on at the lakefront here, if we were to develop it, because I've heard people say before, well, let's just develop this, right? Can't we just get some good economic boosting going on here? But it is one of those things where you're not going to realize what you have until it's gone, right?
Absolutely. And you've got to think about how many corporations, how many businesses move to Chicago specifically because our access to the lakefront and the miles of trails we have. We have the entire trail system on the lakefront is more than 50 miles. There's more than 20 beaches. I mean, this is truly an amenity that we should not be taking for granted. And we need to be thinking long term about how future generations are going to benefit from it.
So at Open Lands, I know that you're working to protect natural and open spaces around this region. So you just issued this report, the Chicago Lakefront, protected yet precarious. So what are you going to do now? What's the next step here?
Yeah, we've reached out to the city. We've had a great reception thus far. We're going to start a dialogue with them and see what's possible as far as next steps to update the Lakefront Protection Ordinance, as well as the district that goes along with it. And we are feeling really good about the potential for some of our recommendations. And we'll keep you up to date. But if people want to learn more and follow our progress, you can visit openlands.org/lakefront. And there you can read our report. There's an executive summary that has a great interactive story map to kind of see the difference between public trust and the Lakefront Protection Ordinance. And you can sign up to receive updates by joining our email list.
openlands.org/lakefront. I like that we can end on an optimistic note, Emily, because these days, you know, it's you never know what you're going to get from one day to the next. So any sort of good news, I feel like we should celebrate that. So I'm happy that you are optimistic. And again, openlands.org/lakefront. Emily Ricewig is the Vice President of Conservation and Policy at Open Lands, a great local nonprofit. Hey, Emily, thanks for talking to us today about the lakefront, and thanks for all of your hard work.
Thank you, Mike.
Chicago's own Anthony Williams, founder of Second Glance Productions, is gaining national recognition as he recently headed to Washington, D.C. for the 16th annual World Music and Independent Film Festival. His latest film, Thicker Than Blood, explores themes of identity, family, and faith within the Black and LGBTQ plus communities. He's been nominated for 6 awards and continues to showcase the power and depth of Chicago-based storytelling on the national stage. We could check out secondglanceproductions.com. And Anthony Williams is here with us on Outside the Loop once again. Anthony, how are you? It's been about a year since the last time you and I talked.
What's up, Mike? Yeah, it has been about a year or so. I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to talk to you again. Lots of good things happening in your world, which is always great to hear. So let's just remind folks what you're all about here. You founded Second Glance Productions back in 2009. Remind us what you set out to do with this.
Well, actually, I founded Second Glance Productions, in 2009, but it was in North Carolina. I ended up bringing it here to Chicago when I relocated. And we're all about making sure that we can find the heart in people's story and connect that to the world. And what we mean by that is really just being able to create a space to tell stories from marginalized voices, particularly the LGBTQ and the Black community voices. And a lot of our projects often focus on themes of either faith, holistic healthcare, and that means spiritual, sexual, emotional, physical, and the other health, mental health. That's the other one.
That's an important one.
Very important, very much so. And so, that's what we're really all about, is making sure that we can tell these different stories in different ways, but in a way that can connect with audiences from many different parts of lived experiences.
Right. And that importance of representation in film and other media, that's really vital. And, you know, the communities that are encompassed in the LGBTQ plus community, they, you know, can't always say that they've had that representation. And that's even though a lot of us might think like, oh, so what's the big deal? But that is a big deal. If you don't see your lived experiences in entertainment, That has an impact on folks, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge deal, and it has a huge impact just because we learn by seeing. And so as we go through life, if we see no representations of anything that looks like us, whether it's the color of our skin, whether it's the way that we live our lives, whether it's the experiences that we go through in our life, if we don't see that, we often feel as if we're alone in the things that we experience when in fact we're not. And that's why I think it's really important, you know, in the work that we do, but just in life in general, for people to know that we're more alike than we are different. And I think that once people start to realize that and start to talk about their experiences with people that don't look like them, they find out that they have way more in common than they do differences.
And it's a human thing. I mean, you peel it all back, we're made of the same stuff. We have the same needs and wants and emotions and ups and downs, no matter mm-hmm. if you're gay, straight, black, white, male, female, or something in between. Mm-hmm. We are all human beings, and I think sometimes we lose that very sense of humanity because we're so concerned about classification and separating ourselves. But you're right, we have so much more in common than we do, you know, that differentiates us. But we forget that sometimes, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We really do. And I really feel like, too, that, you know, sometimes if people feel as if they recognize that or honor that or step into that, then that takes away something from themselves, which in fact is not true. If anything, it adds to you and your lived experience and, you know, who you can be as a human. And so I feel, yeah, absolutely. It's very important to have that representation, because, again, if you don't see yourself, then you can't. You feel as if you're in things by yourself, and that's not true at all.
Yeah. I want to get to the film Thicker Than Blood in a minute here, but I have to ask you, I mean, we are living in some pretty weird times, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
And doing this kind of work now where you're focusing on representation of different groups of people and some of the intersections of those representations. You know, we have a government right now that, and I'm not trying to get political, but look. I
mean, go there. Let's do it.
But here we go. I mean, they've said that diversity and inclusion isn't a good thing and should be avoided. So you doing very much that thing in entertainment here and what you're doing with the arts and film. How are you operating in this time that we're living in?
Well, I'm going to back up and address one thing that you said first. This administration says a lot of things that are not true. We all have seen it. We've all heard it. And we're all living it. And so I really feel that that kind of emboldens me and empowers me even more to do what I do. Just because I love a challenge. I've never backed down from a challenge. I've never been scared of anything, you know, especially when it comes to sharing my story and sharing my truth. And then when I recognize that there are a lot of other people who experience the same thing that I've gone through, then I, you know, recognize that I'm not in a silo. So everything that I do is not only just to, you know, to express who I am as an artist, but it's also aimed to really help people get through what they're going through, because where we're living right now, it is just hard to wrap my brain around the things that we're experiencing in this moment. And the fact that this administration is coming after literally everybody that does not look like them or believe the same things that they do, like everything that this administration is saying, you know, is pushing toward is nothing what this country is about. This country was not founded on any of the ideologies that this administration is pushing. And so I think that it warrants even more of a fight to hold on to the things that we have, that hold on to our rights, pretty much. I mean, honestly, it's what it is. These are all human rights. These are rights that are afforded to people, no matter who you are. And you can't just wave, you know, a pen. You can't just say things and it be warranted as true. And you can't just kind of push people back into a closet and expect them not to fight. And so this is my way of fighting. And I know that for a fact that society, we learn from media, whether it's social media, whether it's books, whether it's music, whether it's TV and film. And the more that you have honest, truthful representation in those media, in those realms of media, the more people can feel empowered to be themselves, to live their own lives, and to do what's best for themselves, as well as what's best for the people around them. And so when I say that I'm moving forward ahead with what my purpose is and what my call is, with what I'm doing with our projects, what I'm doing with Second Glance Productions, I'm not stopping until I take my last breath. And I'm praying that everything that we're putting our hands to will hopefully help bring people out of the dark times that we're living in, and to help them realize that they're not alone, and there are there's power and strength in numbers. And so the more that we can band together, the better we can get through the times that we're living in right now.
And it's about humanity. I think everything you just said, right? We can relate it back to people have different experiences, different lived experiences, and that's okay. That makes us stronger when we understand where we're coming from. And we should celebrate that, I think. And I think you do too. And let's talk about celebrating some of this, because your new film, Thicker Than Blood, is really something that's been recognized. Briefly, tell us about what this film is.
Yeah, so Thicker Than, there's this running joke that Thicker Than Blood is the film that will never die. So this film, Thicker Than Blood, is the first in a three-part film series about a young man that returns home to celebrate his older brother being promoted at work. And you get to see why he's left home for 3 years, and as well as how this family and their dynamic justifies their faith in treating people the way that they do from the communities of the LGBT community, as well as people who are living with HIV. And so, as you said in the beginning, this film meets at the intersections of Black voices, public health, the LGBT community, and faith. And so we released it in 2017, and it really has just taken on a life of its own. It's been everywhere. It's been in nonprofit organizations and teaching institutions and film festivals and, you know, public and private screenings all across, not even just this country, but across the world. And so the fact that, you know, it's still being recognized 7-8 years later is just a testament not only to, you know, the power of what we can do with film and media, but also just the power of the message in this film. I feel like a lot of people that have seen it may not come from, you know, backgrounds of faith. They may not, you know, identify as LGBTQ, but they all walk away with something from this film. And people, you know, who see it have personally come up to me and said that there are aspects of this film that have changed their lives, and not only just their life, but their relationships with the people in their lives. And so the fact that we can still be going strong 8 years later with Thicker Than Blood, I'm so humbled and just so honored, in all honesty.
Well, congratulations on all of the accolades and the great work. And is it true that this movie, Thicker Than Blood, is coming to Amazon Prime?
That is true. So after we finish this last festival run in DC, hopefully this time, by the fall, it will be available to the public on Amazon Prime. Right now, it is available for rent or purchase at secondglanceproductions.com. So people are able to get an early access there, but it should be widely available on Amazon Prime coming soon. So I also wanted to mention that Thicker Than Blood holds two major awards from two international film festivals. So we've won Best Director in a Feature Film, as well as the Best Feature Film, two separate international film festivals in 2019. And I'm even just excited to say that we're nominated for 6 awards at the World Music and Independent Film Festival. So we're just excited. Just excited.
Great work that you are doing, and important work. And I say keep it going, Anthony, because we need more voices like yours. And your voice brings together other voices and other experiences. And I think that's really important, because that makes up who we are as a people. And so we can check out secondglanceproductions.com. Anthony Williams, the founder of Second Glance Productions. Hey, congratulations, Anthony, on everything. And keep doing what you're doing, man, because I think there's more good stuff down the road for you. Thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And let's talk some local music right now from Rob Moore. He is a local guitarist and vocalist, and he is just rocking the blues. He will be performing at the Windy City Hot Dog Fest on Saturday, May 31st at 6 p.m. That's in the Portage Park neighborhood in Chicago. And we can check out robmoore-guitar.com. Rob, welcome to Outside the Loop. You sound great, man.
Well, thanks. Good to be here.
So Your, I guess, full name, Rob Wild Boar Moore. Where does the Wild Boar come from?
Well, I had that name actually since I was about 15 years old. Through some adversity, I was, as a kid, I got picked on a lot as adolescents, and life wasn't really fun, but I'd get very angry at a certain point when people were tormenting me. And it was about the same time. Well, first of all, that name seemed to stick with me, you know, through high school and much farther through my life. It was also around the same, I guess, because of what I was experiencing, I discovered the blues. The blues was like a therapy. You know, it helped me overcome some of the negative feelings that I had. You know, and I started putting my energy into becoming a blues guitarist when right. I was in high school.
Right. Yeah. So you've been playing blues for over 50 years. And you talked about right there sort of channeling your energy into the blues. But boy, you had a chance to sit in with some of the greats like Muddy, Otis Rush, Sam Lay. I mean, how does that happen? Because I've heard that before in Chicago that, you know, some folks early on were able to sit in with these guys. But how did it happen for you?
Well, it's interesting. I started going out to clubs. There was a club called Alice's, which you could go as long as you were past the curfew age. They didn't serve alcohol. And I heard Otis Rush there, and he just knocked me out. And I'd go home after, you know, right after we left there, and I'd pick up the guitar and try to remember what he was doing. You know, of course, I wasn't nearly as accomplished as, you know, as I was later. But I did that. And then I did have an opportunity later. I kept going there, and eventually I met Otis. The whole Chicago scene was and is interesting in that there are these people, particularly in the past, you know, who are considered iconic figures in the music world, you know, related to rock, etc. Mm-hmm. These musicians were just playing basically most of their gigs were in clubs, you know, so it was really easy to approach them. Now, in the case of Muddy, actually, I had an opportunity where I had a friend who was promoting some concerts, and I told him, well, why don't we have Muddy? We had this underground newspaper in the suburbs. I was a small part of it. Mm-hmm. But my friend was the editors. He had bands like REO playing for these to raise money, you know, for this newspaper. REO was, they were Speedwagon when they were just, you know, a band out of Central Illinois.
Right.
But I said, why don't book blues bands? And so he thought it was a good idea. And we had heard that Muddy had his name in the phone book. So we called him. And my friend just, you know, he negotiated a deal, you know, to play a show in the South Suburbs. And at the end of the conversation, my friend said, well, by the way, I've got a good friend who's a blues player and he really likes your music. Do you mind if I bring him over to your house when I come with the contract? So the first time I met Muddy was actually at his house. And he asked me, he handed me a guitar and said, play something. And I did. And then he said, I'll let you sit in on one song. He had like a two-story house. The house is a museum now, but he had a rehearsal space in the basement. And after we signed the contract and talked, he said, well, I've got a rehearsal now. You can come to the rehearsal if you'd like. So we went down to the basement. His whole band was sitting there. You know, these guys, Pine Top Perkins, Mojo Buford, all these wow. guys, Sammy Lawhorn. And so we just sat there, and, you know, while they rehearsed a couple songs. And then it was a night or two later, they were playing at Alice's. And we went to the show. And then when I sat in with him on this gig, I played one song and I walked off and he called me back to finish the set. So that was nice.
Wow.
But then after this experience, you know, I'd go out places and try to meet musicians, but I'd tell them, I said, well, I sat in with Muddy. And at that point, you know, they'd usually pay some attention to me. So I got to sit in with people, a lot, you know, quite a few bands, I still was sitting in with Otis frequently, this was early 70s. And, I got to sit with Eddie Clearwater and Lonnie Brooks and Sam Lane, all kinds of people like that. And then, after a while, I started getting gigs. I mean, I wasn't all that great at the time, looking back, but they were just really nice, all those people were really nice to let me sit in. They didn't really have to, but I was just a young kid. But when you're exposed to it, and when you're getting up there doing it, even if you're sounding not so good at one point, you're learning a lot. And you're bound to get better. I mean, tell people you just keep playing, and you're get better. I mean, I suppose there's limits to some bare. We all probably have limits to what we can attain, but. But if you keep playing, you're going to improve.
Yeah, and it's really the best musical education you can get when you're sitting in with those professionals, with those legends of blues, of course. And so this gig coming up on May 31st, it's a Saturday at the Windy City Hot Dog Fest. You go on at 6 o'clock. This is in Portage Park, pretty much the Six Corners area, that 4000 North Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly.
Corner. Yeah.
It's just north of the corners there, so which is at Irving Park and Milwaukee and Cicero. They all come together there.
And the album Chicago Dog, that's out right now. That's on all the streaming platforms and on your website, robmore-guitar.com. Is that the best way to get that record?
Yeah, I'd say so. Spotify. Well, basically, we're on all the platforms. It shouldn't be hard to find if you look for it.
All right. And the blues, I mean, it's still kicking after all these years. It's still alive and well. I mean, can we say that? Is it alive and well? You're still playing it after 50 years. People are still, into it, but it's doing okay.
Chicago has a very good blues scene, but I don't think it's quite as good as it was, in the 70s when I was around. And even before I came around, I hear it was even better. I know it was better, because we had the people that were innovating the music. So many of them were out of Chicago. But now there are people playing blues all over the world, which was a different thing. There was a time when it was just kind of unusual for white people to play blues, but it's, the people playing it in Asia and in Europe and South America. So that's an interesting thing. And of course, with the internet, people get reviewed, on publications. They might be from Italy or France, or they might be, from the south side of Chicago or from Mississippi, So, but it's gotten to be more of an international thing.
Well, the blues is good stuff, and you are all in it. And we can check out robmore-guitar.com. The website for Rob the Wild Boar Moore, who is a local guitarist and vocalist, will be performing on Saturday, May 31st at 6 p.m. as part of the Windy City Hot Dog Fest. That's in Portage Park in the Six Corners area, 4000 North Milwaukee. The latest album from Rob Moore is called Chicago Dog. Rob, it sounds great. Good luck with everything going forward, man. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll talk soon.
Great. I look forward to it, Michael. Thanks a lot.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 969 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson. He's our engineer in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.